Welcome to the Jacksonville First Seventh-day Adventist Church podcast, where we listen, learn, and love together. We hope you enjoy this inspiring message.
How does God heal the wounds of the past? Ernest Hemingway said, "The world breaks everyone, and afterward many become strong at the broken places." Have you ever noticed that some people really thrive in spite of great difficulty, and other people can have actually comparatively less difficulty and don't thrive? I'm going to try to break down for you why that is the case in such a way that it helps you feel empowered, that you have options. All of your decisions have not been made for you by circumstances. You have what we call in psychology an internal locus of control. You see that even though things happen that you don't have control of, you still are empowered by God with agency and volition to be able to make choices, to do the best thing with your circumstances. 1/3 to 2/3 of abused children do not become abusive. So not everybody that is raised in an abusive environment then goes on to abuse others. What we do in behavioral science is we don't always ask what happens when things go wrong. We ask what happens when things go what? What's happening with the 1/3 to 2/3 that don't go on to abuse? Apparently, they're able to rise above and get better instead of bitter. We call that sometimes resilience. So we have varying levels of resilience, but what we want to do is increase our resilience, increase our ability to get past life's difficulties, and instead of getting bitter, get better. So let's look at some of the things that get in the way of that and some of the things that also contribute to various moral and spiritual failures that we experience. See, because we all have weaknesses, and we have weaknesses that are very specific to us. One person has a weakness for addictive sexuality, another one has a weakness for overeating, another one has a weakness for gossiping, another one has a weakness for a temper issue. I struggled with temper for much of my life. My father gave me the genetics, and I just had that example set, and I ended up being kind of a hothead, really, for a lot of years. I'm better now, but there's a whole story behind that, how God showed me how not to lose control. Our tendencies come from nature, nurture, and choice. Nature, nurture, and choice. In my field, behavioral science, there's a lot of emphasis on nature and nurture, but they don't talk about choice much. Why? Because they can't explain it. And scientists like to explain everything. So the fact that they can't explain choice, they just say, oh, it doesn't exist, or some of them say that anyway. But what I'd like to do is break these down one by one and just unpack what I mean by nature, nurture, and choice. Let's talk first about nature. And let's talk specifically about genetics. These are my two daughters. I love to use these seminars as an excuse to show family slides, right? So these are my two beautiful, beautiful young adult daughters. And I just like to do this. Which one do you think was the more mischievous? The one on the right or the one on the left? How many of you think the one on the right was more mischievous? Raise your hand. Okay. How many of you think the one on the left was more mischievous? Why do you think that? How do you know? Well, they're both wonderful young ladies, but yeah, this one gave us a run for our money. When she was growing up, man, she was a trip. So let me just share some funny things that genetics can do. There's such a thing as a phenylthiocarbamide taster. You know how some people think that broccoli is awful and they hate it? Well, cruciferous vegetables can taste bitter to people that have this trait, this phenylthiocarbamide tasting. Let's do a little experiment here. Clasp your hands, okay? And make a note of which thumb is on top, the right or the left. And let's say, raise your hand if your left thumb is on top. Okay, raise your hand. And keep your hand up if you are left-handed. No. So this, okay, now try clasping the other way. Isn't it weird? It feels very weird. You naturally clasp one way, and the thumb that you put on top is different for each person. one of two choices, but different for each person. It has nothing to do with handedness. It's just random genetics. It's just genetics doing their thing. So let me share another little thing with you about genetics. This wonderful gift runs in my family. I can actually do this. I don't do it as well as my niece does, but my sister can do this just as well as she can. And I think two, what's that? You can't, let me see. Unbelievable. She's a tri-cornered hat person. That's amazing. So what's the point of it? Like, some people can't even roll their tongue. You know, you know, yeah, how many of you can do that? Try it. Some people lack, can you roll? Yeah. So some people lack the ability to roll their tongue. Doesn't mean they're not articulate. Doesn't mean they can't talk. It's just a random thing. And then some people are extra gifted, and they can do the tri-cornered hat thing. And this is my niece. But I think my sister's kids, I think 3 out of 4 of them can do this. Random stuff. But genetics are like that. They dance. They do all kinds of strange things. We get a package of traits from our genetics. You are born with a lot of different tendencies and often pathological or even moral tendencies, things that you'll be inclined toward. The way that we measure this in science is through twin studies. We take people who are identical twins who have exactly the same DNA, but who are raised in different environments through adoption or whatever, and then you measure the enduring traits in that person, if they have a tendency to gain weight or if they're same-sex attracted or whatever. And we assume that there's some kind of genetics at play if that trait endures through different environments. There's all kinds of questions that come up in that process. Let's talk about nurture for a moment here. Nurture is basically our environment. And I would extend nurture all the way back to prenatal environment, because that's really important. The environment in that woman's womb, the mood of the woman, the happiness level of the woman, the things that that woman goes through, any trauma she endures, those are all going to affect who? The baby. That's right. So let's just rattle off some of these. A prenatal environment. Another big player is what's called touch stimulation in infancy. So I understand that there was an orphanage in South America, had 97 orphans. And gradually they started dying off until they only had 21 left. 76 of the 97 died. They didn't know what it was from. It wasn't an infection. They weren't malnourished. The children were not being held. What we're noticing also is that children who are raised in these orphanages where they don't get enough skin contact end up with literal brain issues where they can't function because they didn't develop normally neurologically, so they have educational and social and sometimes other deficits. The good news is the brain is flexible and you can learn new tricks. That's a good thing. I don't want to discourage anyone if you're raised in a hostile or somehow negative environment, but those things do impact you. So that environment, and particularly touch stimulation in infancy, helps to develop the brain, and I'm going to be talking in more detail about that. I think it's Friday night. Children learn by imitation. So you grow up in a certain home environment, you watch your parents conduct themselves a certain way, and you are going to imitate that behavior. This is why, you know, you meet a certain family and they all laugh like, you know, they're imitating each other. They have a certain trait, a certain idiosyncrasy that is passed down through imitation and maybe some genetics thrown in there. Who knows? There's a lot of gray area between. But an additional way in which we learn by imitation is we watch the behavior of the people around us. And we adopt the thinking that is behind that behavior. So let me give you an example. If you grow up in a home where every time things get tense, daddy turns to alcohol to cope with the stress, then you get the message that life is overwhelming and cannot be managed without some kind of escape. That's the message you get. And often you will end up forming your core beliefs, which are subconscious, subverbal beliefs that you're not even fully aware that you believe. And you end up with a set of core beliefs that carry into your adulthood, and you can be led down the same road. Does it make sense? So you learn by imitation in both of those ways. Another big player in our development process, or what we might call nurture, is trauma that we experience. So I'm going to be talking about trauma for a little while here. I'm in a doctoral program for community counseling with a concentration in traumatology, so I'm having trauma for breakfast, lunch, and dinner these days, reading about it all the time. So I'm going to be sharing a few things with you about trauma. But I want to first touch on the third component that contributes to who we are, and that's choice. Because regardless of your inheritances, regardless of what genetic package you got, regardless of your home environment growing up and all the things that come to you in life, all the things you have no control of, you still have a what? A choice. And that choice, the way we exercise choice, is often to reinforce the package of traits that have come to us through inheritance. So if you end up in a substance abusing home, then you think, well, I guess I can't manage life without some kind of escape. And you take your first what? Drink, and it activates your genetics, and you end up taking a second drink and then a third drink. And pretty soon you've chosen your way into the very same situation. That's how it all works. Often these things dovetail together, but it's still possible for a human being to say, no, I don't want to follow the path that my dad followed. I want to follow a different path. And they can seek support to make better choices, and it's possible for people to escape out of those things. Can I hear a hearty amen to that? We do have choices no matter what our setbacks. But let me just use myself as a guinea pig to illustrate what I'm talking about. So as I mentioned previously, I had a struggle with anger. I'm a slow burner. I would be laid back and pretty accepting, but things would get to a certain point and I would blow and I would yell. My father was the same way. In fact, I'm pretty sure I inherited that tendency from him. I probably inherited some genetic tendencies toward impatience and anger from him, but I also watched him do the exact same thing the entire time I was growing up. He wasn't an abusive man, but he would get angry, and he and I would get into knockdown, drag out kind of situations where he'd end up wrestling me to the floor if I got too out of control. It was bad. One time my brother got in kind of an argument with him, and my brother went running out of the house, and he had the presence of mind to slam the door behind him. It was a screen door. My dad pushed it straight off the hinges. So he wasn't like abusive, but he would get angry and he'd see red and he'd be like supercharged with adrenaline. He'd do crazy things. So I grew up with that example. And so my way of dealing with a very stressful situation was to blow up. I remember once I tried not to blow up at my husband in front of my kids. And my husband was usually the one that I would blow up at, because we tend to treat the people we're closest to the worst. The people we know won't go away. They won't dump us. You know, we put on the good behavior for the more fragile relationships, but those relationships that are solid, we're kind of our worst selves. It shouldn't be that way, but it's the way it is. So I would blow up with my husband. I would always try to hide it from the kids, though. I didn't want them to see that. But occasionally they would. So this one particular time, there was an issue going on, and I blew up. And the way that my husband functions is I get louder, he gets quieter. Right? So I was getting louder. He was getting, my little girl was there, and I felt very bad about it. And parents need to be willing to apologize to their kids when they've acted wrongly. Our authority is built on God, not on ourselves. So I knew that I had to humble myself. And I went into my daughter and I said, I wanted to apologize to her. But before I could say anything, she said, Daddy had a short temper. I was like, why is she saying he had a short temper? I was the one that was yelling. And she looked at me and said, and you had a long temper. So that was my background. That's my situation. And I remember the moment God started to give me the victory over my anger was that I identified the core belief behind losing my temper. And the core belief was this: that I could not let my husband be awful to me. If he wanted to be awful to me, I had to make him change. It was my responsibility to make him treat me a certain way. And I learned that no, it is not my responsibility to directly control him. My responsibility is to remove myself from a situation that is untenable or that is stressful. So if he's not acting well, if he's not being kind, I can remove myself from him, put some distance, then pray to Jesus, get a walk in some kind of way, get my battery recharged, and come back to the situation when I'm more fortified. Now I work with married couples. This is something I recommend to all married couples that ever escalate or have conflict, and a lot of them do. Use timeout. That's your code word. And you make the sign. Either partner can call time out anytime they want. However, whoever calls time out is responsible for scheduling, coming back and talking it through. Preferably schedule it right then and there. If you can't handle that, you're too hot, come back around. But it's an understanding and a contract you make as a couple that if someone calls time out, they are responsible for scheduling the follow through. Does this make sense? The reason you want to do that is because if you don't schedule that follow through, then it feels like abandonment. Time out, I'm leaving, I don't like you. And then people can get triggered and it can go downhill. But if you say, we're going to come back to this, we're going to talk this through, we're committed to that, but right now I can't do it, time out, then that person reschedules. Make sense? And so that's a really good thing to bring into your marriage. And I learned that I could do that very thing. And I learned that I did not have to deal with it immediately. I thought I had to deal with it immediately. And I thought I had to change my husband. But I don't have to change him. It's God's responsibility to change him. Once I refuted and changed that core belief, I was able to have self-control and I'm much better. And he would probably tell you that if he wasn't mad at me for something. So anyway. All right. Let's look at this statement. It's a great statement. A genuine conversion changes hereditary and cultivated. So the hereditary is the nature and nurture, and the cultivated is the choice. Because every time we choose, it becomes part of who we are, you know, and entrenches those patterns. A genuine conversion changes hereditary and cultivated tendencies to wrong. Isn't that good to know? God gets down under the layers of who we are, under the substrata of our characters, and starts to exhume these things and starts to make seismic changes. So it's possible for us who are upside down to be right side up when the will, the human will, connects with the grace and power of Jesus, and then God is able to right what is wrong. Let's talk for just a minute here about epigenetics. How many of you have heard of epigenetics? So I'm going to give you a little science lesson here. The double helix figure looks like a twisted ladder. That's DNA. And then if you take a short segment of that, that's called a gene. And if you take the ladder and you twist it over and over and bunch it up together to form either X or Y, you have what are called what? Chromosomes, right? Okay, science class here. Your mother and your father each gave you 23 chromosomes, and they're literally kind of cut and pasted into the file that is you. Make sense? So there's this science now called gene expression or epigenetics, and it essentially says that we can activate or deactivate our genes. So you have certain genetic tendencies toward alcoholism or sexual addiction or anger or obesity or whatever, but you don't have to activate those genes. If you live a holistic, healthy lifestyle and abstain from all of those things, you're going to be putting yourself in a situation where you have a lot less difficulty and conflict in resisting those temptations. And this is a general principle of the Christian walk, and that is we should avoid temptation whenever possible. We should reduce the temptation load that's upon us in every way we can and be as untempted as possible. Will there be times when we cannot avoid temptation? There will, yes or no? Yes, there will be times we can't avoid it, but we want to avoid it and face it. You know, if we're constantly like putting ourselves in temptation's way, what is that already doing, kind of? It's kind of like Eve going near the tree, right? Like, what are you saying? You're saying you really want to be tempted. So we should reduce our temptation in every way possible. And one of the ways we do that is to keep our lifestyle really clean. and don't engage in usage of substances, those things so quickly become addictions. Alcohol, so quickly, we're so quickly triggered into alcoholism. I have a friend whose father was an alcoholic, and he was so intent upon not triggering his genes to become an alcoholic himself that he would not even use cough medicine because it has a little bit of alcohol. And I'm not saying we all have to do that, but I'm saying he was that conscious of that problem. And so we need to make it as easy upon ourselves as possible. We need to turn off those genes whenever we can. Okay, let's talk about trauma and how it affects us. Do you know that trauma is associated with just about every health problem, every physical health problem? Here's a list that have been documented to be connected to a condition called post-traumatic stress disorder. How many of you have heard of PTSD? What do you think of when you think of PTSD? People coming home from the military, that's right, from being in a war zone. But do you know who the other large sector of individuals that develop PTSD is? Because women get PTSD twice as often as men do. What is the sector of women that get PTSD? Women who have suffered sexual violence. That's your other big swath of people. You've got the military, the guys that have been in the battlefield, and then you've got the women who've been raped or abused over here. So those are the two big sort of swaths of people. And they're associated with all these different illnesses. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about adverse childhood experiences, and the reason is because it used to be thought that the only person who could claim to have suffered trauma is someone who was in a near-death experience. And in fact, to qualify for PTSD, you have to either hear about or see or actually be threatened with death. It's a very severe trauma that you're exposed to qualify for PTSD. But because people in my field know that not everybody who is struggling with the effects of trauma has faced anything that physically threatening, there's a new kind of PTSD, and that's called CPTSD, complex PTSD. I mean, think about it. Peter, standing there in the Garden of Gethsemane, it was a quadrant of soldiers or whatever they called it. These were armed men, men skilled in the art of death, and Peter pulls out his what? And whacks off someone. Was Peter afraid of dying? Absolutely not afraid of dying. But only hours later, he's in the guard room with Jesus, and he denies him with cursing and swearing because he's facing social death of ridicule. What's more frightening to people, physical or social? You know, so we're psychological, social beings. So that's why we need another diagnosis. Hasn't made it into the diagnostic manual yet, but we need another diagnosis that connotes this type of trauma. Relational and emotional trauma can be very severe. So PTSD kind of helps us with that. And what CPTSD says is that people that are exposed to smaller levels of trauma over a longer period of time suffer some of the same effects as people who are faced with a huge amount of trauma in one discrete period of time. Does that make sense? So if I were to come over to you, and if I were to touch you like this, would that be traumatic in any way, shape, or form? Or how about if I tapped you like that? Okay, but if I did that for 4 days, it would start to hurt. I'm serious. It would start to hurt. And so that's kind of how CPTSD works. So we came to an awareness of CPTSD through these studies that were done called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Studies. And I want to give you a story that's behind these studies. It was a man named Dr. Vincent Felitti, and he worked with a Kaiser Permanente weight loss clinic. And he noticed that a lot of people who were losing weight in the weight loss clinic would drop out. And he couldn't understand why they're losing the weight. Why are they dropping out? And he started to wonder if maybe he could figure out why these people were leaving the program. And he started to interview them. And he was in an interview with a young woman. And he thought he was going to ask her, he was being kind of absent-minded, he thought he was going to ask her, what was the age of your first sexual experience? And instead he said, what was your weight at your first sexual experience? And she said, 40 pounds. And then he asked again, what was your weight at your first sexual experience? She said, 40 pounds. And then she looked down at the floor and she said, it was my father. She was a 40-pound child. That's what she was saying. She was, you know, listening to what he said. He was like, wait a minute, I didn't say that right. You know, you understand? So in that moment, you know, sometimes thinkers struggle with a problem for a long time, and then all of a sudden the light goes on. And in that moment, the light started to go on. And what happened with the follow-up research, and they interviewed over 17,000 people, he discovered that what was going on there was that the vast majority of the people dropping out of the clinic had experienced sexual abuse as children. So then they come up with this idea of adverse childhood experiences. And what this shows is that, and you guys can't see this super well, but these experiences lead to disrupted neurodevelopment, to emotional and cognitive problems, to adoption of health risk behaviors, disease and disability, and then early death. Not everybody, but it creates a trend in that direction. So trauma is a very serious issue. Now, I'm, like I said, having trauma for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I'm telling you, it can get real depressing after a while. And as I'm studying trauma, I'm comparing it with what the scriptures say. Because if you look at the scientific literature, sometimes you can come to the conclusion that trauma ruins people for life. And that just seems so awful, that God would let some people get so wounded that they'd be ruined for life at a time when they had no choices at all, right? So I'm comparing that message with what I see in scripture in verses like this, God saying, I'll make it up to you. I'll make up the years that the swarming locust has eaten. And the person goes, well, what about the creeping locust? And God says, the creeping locust. What about the crippling locust? Well, the crippling locust too. What about the gnawing locust, God? Well, the gnawing locust too. My great army which I send among you. And all of those are different phases of caterpillars and different kinds of caterpillars that work devastation. God is saying, I will make it all up to you. All the damage that you've experienced, even the damage you brought upon yourself, I can make it up to you. So I look at that message in scripture and I compare it with this idea that once you've been traumatized, you're wrecked for life. And I start to struggle. And this is where I get in this battle between psychology and biblical revelation. And what I come to from both biblical revelation and science is that trauma is part of the story, but not all of the story. I look at these texts, for instance, the trying of your faith works patience. Tribulation works patience. For this light affliction, you know this one, which is but for a moment, works for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. I keep seeing this word works over and over. That is the word katergizetei, and it means to work down to the end point or to bring to decisive finality. In other words, the end game for God is that he's going to work something into us and develop our characters into his image through some of these difficulties. It is those difficulties that are the grist in the mill of our character development. And I don't know about you, but I want to be like Jesus, right? And I would like the difficulties that are unavoidable, that are part of life, to serve some higher purpose, wouldn't you? And I would argue that if they do serve a higher purpose, it's going to take the edge off the suffering. So what I did at this point, I'm looking at the scriptures, it says that there's some benefit that comes out of trauma. And I'm thinking, I bet there's science somewhere that talks about this. And I discovered there's a whole field called post-traumatic growth. And I want to tell you about it. And in order to tell you about it, I'm going to share the story of this woman, Kay Wilson. In December of 2018, this tour guide, her name was Kay Wilson, and her friend were attacked by Arab terrorists in a Jerusalem forest. Kay's friend died, but Kay lived and crawled to safety through bleeding, though bleeding from 13 stab wounds. They left her for dead, basically, but she survived. She had punctured lungs, a diaphragm, dislocated shoulder, broken shoulder blade, and a broken sternum. She was just all busted up, but she crawled to safety. And she ended up living and decided to turn that trauma into benefit. So she's now in really what I would call a ministry where she speaks, and look her up on TED Talks and stuff. Very, very inspiring, very articulate person. Look it up. This woman took a horrific experience and turned it into benefit to other people. She says, "I believe with an imperfect faith in a God of justice who has promised that vengeance is his. The question is not why did this happen to me, but rather how can I incorporate this grisly event into the rhythm of my life in a manner that guards me from becoming like those who tried to murder me." Isn't this inspiring? I just find it totally inspiring that people can make this choice. So, are you interested in learning how your traumas and the traumas of those you love can be transformed into growth? What they find is that post-traumatic growth can benefit people in terms of development and a list of other things, but they still suffer the trauma. It's not like it takes away all the distress completely. But because of the benefits of post-traumatic growth, a person can experience heightened appreciation of life, greater sense of relationships with others, a greater desire for relationships, new possibilities in life, personal strength, and spiritual change. Those can all come along with post-traumatic growth. So the question is, what traits in that individual predict or make it likely that we'll experience growth? Because, you know, some people get better and some people get what? Bitter. How many of you want to be on the better side? Raise your hand. Okay. So here's the way. And this is science. It's biblical too. Spirituality. But a certain way of seeing God. What they find is that if people see God as, and the misfortunes of their life as judgments from God, they're not going to be able to process that trauma as well. But if they see it as God allowed these things to happen in spite of his love for them, then they will be able to process that trauma. Another one is social support. And that is why our churches need to be, really, honestly, the church is a mental health institution. I know it seems like it's full of crazy people, and yeah, but it's not just that. It's that it is a place of social connection. And social connection is the mediator of mental health to people. It is so essential to mental health. So social support before and after the trauma is essential to the best outcome. Something called acceptance coping, and you see this acceptance coping in Kay Wilson. She says, "I'm not going to keep asking why. I'm going to ask how." In other words, it happened. I accept it. Moving forward, how can I make the best of it? Can I get you guys to commit to that one thing, to that attitude of And instead of saying why, and regretting what has happened, I am going to ask how. How can I best respond to this difficulty and help other people respond to this? Does this make sense? You guys with me? And then finally, opportunity for emotional disclosure. All right, so I want to talk about healing from past hurts in summary here. These are the things that I've boiled it down into. How do we heal from the past hurts? We gain insight. I became this way because this happened to me. It's okay to connect those dots. Counseling can really help with that. We receive comfort from Jesus. We take responsibility for our part moving forward. I like to say this, and I want you to say this with me. I'll say it once, and you can say it with me. It's not your fault. It is your responsibility. Let's say it's not my fault. It is my responsibility. What that means is what happened to me that was out of my control is not my fault, but what I do with it is my responsibility. Make sense? So let's say it together. It's not my fault. It is my responsibility. That's what I mean by taking responsibility. And then finally, forgiveness is part of being able to get better instead of bitter. So I'm going to end with a little talk on forgiveness. You know, Jesus taught on forgiveness, didn't he? And he told the story of a landowner. And it was found that a man owed him $10 million. One of his property managers owed him $10 million. And when the king came, or when the landowner came to him for an account of the properties, the man said, "Have patience with me and I'll pay you all." And the landowner forgave him the entire debt. Then that man went out and found a friend that owed him the equivalent of $20. And rather than forgive that friend, he began to strangle that individual. And then Jesus ends that story by saying that the landowner, the unforgiving property manager was delivered to the tormentors. Doesn't sound very nice, does it? But that's what happened to him because he would not forgive, even though he'd been forgiven such a debt. And so Jesus really set the stage with something that was very sobering and very attention-grabbing when he taught about forgiveness. The Bible teaches two phases of forgiveness, and I did talk about this, I think it was last night or the night before. Can you guys remember? Forgiveness supplied and forgiveness what? Applied, that's right. So this is talking about forgiveness supplied. Forgive our debts as we forgive our debtors. Not all of our debtors are sorry, but we can still forgive them. Whenever you stand praying, if you have anything against anyone, what? Forgive him, that your Father in heaven may also forgive your trespasses. So there's forgiveness supplied and forgiveness applied. This is talking about forgiveness supplied. You can hold in your heart forgiveness for that individual. Let me give you some steps. Number one, you want to define it. What is forgiveness? One of the things that we do is we confuse it with other things. So I did a very pretty comprehensive study of forgiveness from the Bible, and I found that there were three aspects of it: to cover, to send away, and to grace. It reminds me of the story of the woman taken in adultery. She was stood before Jesus. They wanted to stone her. Jesus looked at her, looked at them and said, "He's without sin. Cast the first stone." They all left. You know the story very well. And then he said to her, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." I imagine this woman was half-dressed when they brought her before Jesus. I think he would have put his robe around her, so he would have covered her. But then he sent her away and gave her grace. He said, "I'm giving you power." So this is forgiveness. It's like believing that people can actually change, but it's also being willing to cover what they've done. Forgiveness is not necessarily trust. There are two different things. One of the grave mistakes we make in the church is we have cases of sexual abuse. And sometimes sexual abuse that is perpetrated by church leadership. And rather than deal faithfully with that individual, we go for the cheap grace route. And we smooth it over and we pretend everything's okay. And what we do when we smooth it over is we do horrible violence to the victims because we're telling them that God is not their protector and that God doesn't care about what happened to them. And I can tell you stories, terrible things. One situation in a state that I did not live in, but someone called me about this. The pastor had been harassing a congregant, and I came to learn that there was an associate pastor, female, that worked with that individual. She had gone to the conference and complained the things he was doing to her. It was harassment, terrible harassment for a man of God, just terrible. The conference moved her and left him. And then he had access to the second victim, and I'm sure there was a string of them. It was a horrible thing that he did to this brand new candidate, baptismal candidate, 21-year-old woman. It was terrible. But it happened because the conference was willing, and I'm not telling you who they are, but the conference was willing to just ignore what happened. This is not healthy. You cannot trust people who break trust. They need a period of reparation. And I think in the case of pastors, in this particular situation, pastors abusing congregants, I'm kind of a once and done-er. I know that Ellen White isn't there for everything, but I kind of feel like you forfeited the right to be a pastor when you did that. That's how I lean. But I definitely believe in a period where trust can be rebuilt if they are indeed truly repentant. Forgiveness is not excusing sin. It's not approving of sin. It isn't even really forgetting, because now what we've gone through is part of our story, and we should not be forced to forget it. It's part of what we went through. Forgiveness is also not feeling. You won't always feel forgiving toward a person, even someone you've chosen to forgive. So we want to distinguish forgiveness from the things it is not. Often in the process of forgiving another person, we need to establish distance from them. It's very difficult, especially in an abusive situation, to forgive someone that's ongoingly abusing you. So establish that distance. And the next step that I like to see people take is to survey the damage. You want to know what you are forgiving. And by the way, If you got the book 13 Weeks to Peace, there's a whole worksheet called the Forgiveness Worksheet that goes through this, the fine-tooth comb. And I'm just giving you the bullet points here. But you want to survey the damage. You want to know in what areas have you suffered damage because of what that person did. You want to count the cost of forgiveness. You want to make sure you're doing it from choice. You're not doing it because you have to. So do a pros and cons chart. If I forgive them, all these happen, good things happen, here's the cons, here's the pros and cons of not forgiving them. Break that all down and make an informed decision. And then consider yourself. There's actual research that shows that people that know their own imperfections and have a more realizing sense of their failures and how they have hurt people are more capable of forgiving others. I want to close with a story that you may or may not be familiar with. And I'm just going to read it to you because it's so beautifully written. It's by a woman named Corrie Ten Boom. How many of you know this woman? She was a Dutch, and lived through the Holocaust. So she's going to tell her story. Can you hear me okay? It was in a church in Munich that I saw him. A balding, heavy-set man in a gray overcoat, a brown felt hat clutched between his hands. People were filing out of the basement room where I had just spoken, moving along the rows of wooden chairs to the door at the rear. It was 1947, and I had come from Holland to defeated Germany with the message that God forgives. It was the truth they needed most to hear in that bitter, bombed-out land, and I gave them my favorite mental picture. Maybe because the sea is never far from a Hollander's mind, I like to think that that's where forgiven sins were thrown. When we confess our sins, I said, God cast them into the deepest ocean, gone forever. Now, this woman is speaking in Germany, and some of these people cooperated with the Nazis. And she's talking about forgiveness for them. The solemn faces stared back at me, not quite daring to believe. There were never questions after a talk in Germany in 1947. People stood up in silence. In silence, collected their wraps. In silence, left the room. And that's when I saw him, working his way forward against the others. One moment, I saw the overcoat and the brown hat. The next, a blue uniform and a visored cap with its skull and crossbones. It came back with a rush. The huge room with its harsh overhead lights, the pathetic pile of dresses and shoes in the center of the floor, the shame of walking naked past this man. I could see my sister's frail form ahead of me, ribs sharp beneath the parchment skin. Betsy, how thin you were. And then she says in parentheses, Betsy and I had been arrested for concealing Jews in our home during the Nazi occupation of Holland. This man had been a guard at Ravensbrück concentration camp where we were sent. Now it's after the war. She's delivering a sermon to Germans about forgiveness, and the man walks up to her and she knows who he is. Now he was in front of me, hand thrust out, a fine message, Fraulein, how good it is to know that, as you say, all our sins are at the bottom of the sea. And I, who had spoken so glibly of forgiveness, fumbled in my pocketbook rather than take that hand. He would not remember me, of course. How could he remember one prisoner among those thousands of women? But I remembered him. And the leather crop swinging from his belt. I was face to face with one of my captors, and my blood seemed to freeze. You mentioned Ravensbrück in your talk, he was saying. I was a guard there. No, he did not remember me. But since that time, he went on, I have become a Christian. I know that God has forgiven me for the cruel things I did there, but I would like to hear it from your lips as well, Fraulein. Again, that hand came out. Will you forgive me? And I stood there, I whose sins had again and again to be forgiven and could not forgive. Betsy had died in that place. Could he erase her slow, terrible death simply for the asking? It could not have been many seconds that he stood there, hand held out, but to me it seemed hours as I wrestled with the most difficult thing I had ever had to do, for I had to do it. I knew that. The message that God forgives has a prior condition, that we forgive those who have injured us. If you do not forgive men their trespasses, Jesus says, neither will your Father in heaven forgive you your trespasses. I knew it not only as a commandment of God, but as a daily experience. Since the end of the war, I had had a home in Holland for victims of Nazi brutality. Those who were able to forgive their former enemies were able also to return to the outside world and rebuild their lives, no matter what the physical scars. Those who nursed their bitterness remained invalids. It was as simple and as horrible as that. And still I stood there with the coldness clutching my heart. But forgiveness is not an emotion. I knew that too. Forgiveness is an act of the will. And the will can function regardless of the temperature of the heart. Help, I prayed silently. I can lift my hand. I can do that much. You supply the feeling. And so woodenly, mechanically, I thrust my hand into the one stretched out to me. And as I did, an incredible thing took place. The current started in my shoulder, raced down my arm, sprang into our joined hands. And then this healing warmth seemed to flood my whole being, bringing tears to my eyes. I forgive you, brother, I cried with all my heart. For a long moment, we grasped each other's hands. The former guard and the former prisoner, I have never known God's love so intensely as I did then. Oh, we need this, don't we? Would you like to pray in closing that God leads you down a path of forgiveness, that we can have more forgiveness in our world and in our church and in our families, in our marriages? More grace. We need more grace. Not necessarily stupid forgiveness, not cheap grace, but the real thing that has people who are genuinely dangerous to others held accountable, but still forgiveness in that context.
This podcast is brought to you by the Jacksonville First Seventh-day Adventist Church. Connect with us on www.jaxsda.org or on Facebook and YouTube. We look forward to sharing more inspiring messages with you.